Preston and Steve Fun Size.
We're excited to have our next guest in the studio this morning. It will be, it's 30 years that the album World of Noise came out. And they're celebrating this today with performing at the Keswick Theater, along with the band Fastball and the Nixons. And we would like to welcome Everclear to our studio this morning. Morning, everybody.
Hey. The crowd goes wild.
We have Art and Davey and Freddie and Brian who are all here this morning. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you. You didn't even have to look at that cheat sheet too much. That was pretty good.
Just a little bit. I had a glance. Gotta be. I've a track record of getting people's names wrong, so I never.
Dude. Yeah, as long as you spell them right on the check, that's all that matters.
That's all that matters. We're really extra pleased because you're performing tonight and you're here this morning. Absolutely. That's a big big thing to ask of you guys, but you came in and you were punctual, which we appreciate as well.
Well, so we didn't have a choice. You sent your drivers to come get us. Yeah. They're a little rough around the edges.
Oh, were they? Oh, yeah.
But we kind of like that stuff, so that's okay. You know, management asked me if I wanted to come in. I was like, absolutely. MMR has been a part of Everclear since basically, Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And even Heroin Girl, I think you guys might have played.
Yeah.
And so since 95. So I am very, very honored, and we all are, that you asked us to come in. And,
well, thank you.
And just respectful of the relationship over all these years.
It does feel like a friendship over the years. You know, you've done various gigs. We were at another station prior to MMR, Y100, and here as well. And
they were in the same family, though, right?
Basically, right. But it's good also to see where you are in particular, Art, in your life, and there was a point at which I said, I really like listening to what you have to say. You're with age, it does happen. I'm in your ballpark age-wise. And you do start to put things together. And you have such a wonderful take. And a lot of it has been born out of, trials and tribulations of. And in fact, there's a wonderful documentary that's out about you guys. And it seems like you all are in a good place. It seems this is the sweet spot that a lot of times maybe you don't consider at the beginning of a career, but that when you get to, you're able to be yourselves and just enjoy it. Is that a correct assessment of where you are?
I think that's a great assessment of where I am, and I think us as a band, when we really just started thinking about that, this has been 30 years since I started the band. And it was the same year that my eldest daughter was born, and I moved to Portland, and it was rough, and I had no idea what was going to happen. We were trying to slug it out in the clubs, just another band, and we get a chance to record for $400 in trade, and we recorded every song we had. And I didn't tell the band at the time, those other guys, I didn't tell them that I basically wanted to see if I wanted to keep doing the band.
Wow.
I wanted to see if there was anything in the, if there was any magic in the music, and there was. And I sent it out to people, and people started writing about it, and we got gigs, and we got accepted South by Southwest. So earlier this year, me and Freddie Herrera, my bass player here, we found the actual mixtapes. I thought they were gone.
Oh, wow.
I thought they were gone. They had been traveling with me for moves. I've moved 20 times in the last 20 years.
They were at the bottom of very dirty boxes.
Sonically, they held up, though?
Oh, my God. Yeah. We went into this with this guy who is an archivist, and he had to bake the tapes and clean them. But we put them up against the time in 94 when I licensed it to Capitol, when we signed to Capitol, and they mastered it, and they did it without me. And it was almost a lawsuit because they weren't supposed to do that. And it was really high-endy, but finally I just let it go, and thin and brittle, and we A-beat it versus what we have now, and it just sounds
fun. That's amazing.
All right, I wanted to ask you, with 30 years ago, 92, a transition happened in rock-based music. And, Nirvana led the way, and that Seattle sound hit. And a whole floodgate of bands just fell upon us as music consumers, as listeners, as music fans, and so on. It seemed, from that perspective, like everybody was getting signed to a record label deal. The reality of it was, you know, a bunch of bands did get in, but there are a lot of people who didn't. So you know, it wasn't like all of a sudden you make a band and you hit. You know, you had to have the real deal. You had to back it up. But what were those early days like when that? When this whole new rush of music started getting the exposure that it did?
Well, you know, it's really funny because before 92 and 91, I was living in San Francisco and I had a record label, and it was more alternative country based, but my band, Colorfinger, stupid name, good band, you know, I did my first album where I wrote everything and produced everything, and, you know, it was my first time doing that. And it was way more in that alternative, like, world, like the Replacements and Husker Du and stuff like that, and mm-hmm. Pixies. And a friend of mine was in Europe when Nirvana broke, and he's like, wow, that kind of sounds like my friend Art's band a little bit. And I'm like, I wish. But Nirvana did. They opened the door for everybody in late 1991, and a lot of good, a lot of bad.
Yeah.
But for us, I moved to Portland because my girlfriend was from Portland and she was pregnant. And we moved up there. Plus, she had family there. My oldest sister was living there, so I had family there. And it just made sense.
Okay.
And plus, trying to raise a kid in San Francisco with no money.
Yeah, difficult.
It's one of the most expensive cities in the world. But Portland was just great, but it was hard because we were the people from California, and the locals didn't like that. So we had a hard time getting gigs.
Wow.
But then after World of Noise and I sent it out, people just started writing about it, and even though the local hipsters didn't dig it, people started booking us. We started opening for national bands. We started doing regional tours and local tours. And a year later, in 94, we got signed to Capitol.
I was watching footage of Dave Grohl. It was the earliest days of the Foo Fighters, and you guys were on tour with that.
Actually, no. We were playing a show at the Roseland Theater.
Was that
Roseland in New York City. That's not there anymore. The ballroom, Roseland Ballroom. And we were playing with them. And if you watch the whole scene, they're asking them, I think Kurt Loder's going, so a lot of people say this band is kind of, Everclear is kind of ripping off your old band, Nirvana. He goes, I don't think they sound like Nirvana. Bush sounds like Nirvana.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's a funny clip because everyone looks like they're 9 years old.
I know.
You know, it's amazing, too, and I didn't realize this, but you guys hit, you were 33. Right? When the band really clicked in fully.
Yeah.
And they wanted to play you younger, and you said, I can't do that. Like, you wanted to lie about your age.
Well, you know.
Because everyone at that time seemed like they were in their early 20s, you know?
When I signed, I was 32.
Yeah.
Capitol, after I signed a contract that said I have full control over everything.
Everything.
They were like, no, we're going to tell everybody you're 24. And I'm like, no. You know, and I said it in other words that I can't use on the radio, but I basically said, look, man, I don't need your help to make me look like a jerk. I didn't say jerk. And I can do that all on my own. Trust me, ask any of my ex-wives. They'll tell you.
But you know what? Because you hit, and because of that, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems as if, because you just started bam, 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 almost like you were driven by this sense of urgency, like
sobriety.
Yeah, sobriety. But you were, tearing out, like, out of the gate.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people were like, God, you had like overnight success. I'm like, man, I've been playing in bands since I was 16. We've all been playing in bands since we're like 16.
Yeah.
You know, there's no overnight success. Every band built up and built up and built up to the point that, you know, we're at the right place at the right time.
Right.
Everclear is playing at the Keswick Theater tonight. And Art said we can get three songs this morning. So
awesome.
Let's chat and play if that's cool.
Absolutely.
All right. What song are we going to start off
with? We're going to start with I Will Buy You a New Life.
Outstanding. All right. This is Everclear on MMR.
Money that I owe you, yes, you could pay the bills. I'll give you some more when I get paid again. Hate those people who love to tell you money is the root of all the care. They have never been poor, never known the joy of a welfare Christmas.
Yeah, that 12 string sounds great, man.
Thanks, man.
Beautiful instrument.
Yeah. Our tech, Marcus, just what are you pointing at? I don't know.
Pointing at you. Saying great job.
Saying great job, man.
I'm okay.
Right.
I'll tell you when I'm not okay. I'm 60, dude. I don't make words.
So, Art, I want to ask you that your album's 30 years old, came out in 92, and there's a track on the album called Pennsylvania Is.
Yes.
Can I ask you about that song?
Sure.
All right, so what's about that song?
At the time, back in 1992, here in Pennsylvania, you guys had, was it Bob Casey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was Bob Casey. It was
still
the,
here.
The guy's dad, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was a Democrat, but he was a pro-life Democrat. He was a anti-abortion Democrat because he's very Catholic. And the laws here were very, very, very stringent. And that was a big thing that was going on with Operation Rescue and people like the guy who owns the Detroit Tigers and Domino Pizza that's openly giving money to this these people called Operation Rescue that was bombing abortion clinics all over the place, including in Pennsylvania. And that's what the song was about.
There we go.
You always, you know, you always write what you're passionate about, and you take a lot from your personal life, and that's been very. You've been well. You know, there are some songs like "Father Mine" and "I'll Buy a New Life," and these things are very, very open, therapeutic. I assume for a songwriter to do things like that.
I think so. I think from a point of catharsis. Yeah, I guess you're right. I do it because I just find when people write about Dungeons and Dragons and crap like that, it's just disingenuous. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. I know what I'm talking about with this. I talk about my kids because being a parent is one of the, you know, big things in my life.
Have you ever written something down and gone, okay, that's, I've opened up a bit too much here. That might be too much to present to the public.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I wrote a song called You. That was actually recorded here in Pennsylvania for our last record that we finished called Black is the New Black. And that was a song about me getting raped when I was 8.
Wow.
I had never talked about it before.
Mm, okay.
But it was time to write a song about it. And on my solo record, but we never played it live. We're never going to play it live.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
I don't need to play that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And on my solo record that I put out in 2019, I did a song at the time that I hadn't talked to anybody about, but it was about me having MS, which I was diagnosed with in 2016, but I hadn't, I mean, these, you know, friends and family and people I talked to knew about it, but I wasn't public about it until 2019.
Did I read correctly that they said that you may have had that for much longer before you were diagnosed with it?
They think 15 to 20 years.
No kidding.
Yeah, because that seems like a late diagnosis, yeah.
Yeah, because they found, I was in a car accident, long story short, I was in a car accident in April of 2016. Brakes just froze up, wasn't my fault. Hit a parked car that wasn't supposed to be parked there. 2 weeks later, no one got hurt. 2 weeks later, I started getting a twitch in my neck. And we were talking about rehab and stuff earlier. Mm-hmm. Called my orthopedic surgeon. And he's like, go get an MRI. I'll find out where it is. I'll give you Epidural. You'll be fine. Well, I walk into his office, his little examination room like I always do. And there's like 6 guys in
there. Oh, man.
In this room. That's about as big as behind where you guys are standing there. And they all got like long coats and clipboards. And they all just look at me like that. Mm-hmm. When I walk in, I'm like,
it's not good.
It can't be good. I don't know what this is, but this is not good.
Have you ever had an intervention? Because I know you're sober. I mean, I would imagine it's got to be kind of like that. You're walking into a room, you're like, what the hell is going on here?
No, when I got sobered, there wasn't intervention. There wasn't rehabs, only if you're rich people.
Yeah.
You know, back in 89, that wasn't the thing. It hadn't become a cottage industry yet.
It's funny.
Recovery.
So you're in recovery, I'm in recovery. I got a little over 10 years, which my cousin always says it's a good
Congratulations.
Start. It's a good start, right?
Yeah.
But I love talking to old timers and people that have been around for a long time. And they're like, you know, you guys had like real grit. You know, you didn't have the support system that I have. Or at least that I had early on. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing.
They didn't give us nice drugs for real. They gave us battery acid. We're tough, man.
Well,
I just hit 33 years sober like last week.
33. Wow. Congratulations.
A good start.
I assume people reach out to you for encouragement?
All the time.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I went back to school, college. I started college in the 80s, got my 2-year degree, my AA degree, and then it got... I had to make a choice between going to college, playing in a band, working, making a living, and drinking, becoming a blackout drunk. And obviously, that was way more important than going to school. So at the time, I quit school. And then now I went back, and I'm about a year away from my psychology degree. I've got a full-on life coaching, master life coaching, 3 degrees that I got over the last 2 years, and alcohol drug certifications.
That's phenomenal.
I'm going to work with people as people who are creatives in the creative industry, you know, writers, musicians, actors, producers, stuff like that.
You know, you'd think you'd get a big ding from you know, the diagnosis, finding out, and that would put your sobriety to the test. and yeah, yeah, but you overcame that, and you're in good shape. You work out a fair amount, do you not?
We were talking about that earlier. I do physical therapy. I swim. One of the things about excuse me about MS is that you can't get overheated. It's not good for you. So just running or doing regular kind of cardio is not good for me, except for the fact that my body needs it, right?
Right.
So when we bought our house in 2018, I had to make sure there was either a pool or room for a pool. I live in California, so I built this big ass pool. Really big.
Yeah.
My wife is like, really? Really?
Well, yeah, if you're going to swim.
Foot pool?
Yeah.
Look, I put the hot tub in there for her. Little 6 inches where they sit, you know, little umbrella. I got like
60. You got your laps.
I'm sorry. You know, I got 60 foot of swim lane, and I do it just about every day.
Nice.
And it's good for me. You know, it's good being, you know, we were all in our 50s until April. He just hit 50.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, but he's the fresh blood right there.
Well, speaking of that, before we get another song from you guys, can you tell us a little bit about your bandmates, please?
Sure. On bass and vocals, he likes long walks on the beach.
Yes.
Holding hands.
Hang gliding.
Hang gliding while you're playing bass. Freddie Herrera on the guitar. Davey's been with me for 18
years. Wow.
Wow.
Davey French.
Yeah.
On lead guitar and vocals. And
then the kid.
Back on the drum. The kid. Freddie.
The kid.
Fresh blood. Sweater, as we call him.
Sweater? Sweater?
That's a long
story. How did he earn
that?
All right.
You don't want to go there.
All right.
You have to take your shirt off.
Yeah, take your shirt off.
That's Brian Nolan.
Brian.
Cool. Brian used to play in a band called American Hi-Fi back in the day.
Okay. Oh. Yeah. I remember. In fact, there's a lot of bands. Looking at who all everybody has played with that I'm seeing. Brian, you played with Tracy Bonham as well, the Lemonheads.
Oh,
and
God,
you
yeah.
guys have been in and out of a few different bands throughout the years that, you know, we're all familiar with, which is great. I mean, and you guys all settle in together. So that's really cool.
This incarnation's been around for, I think, about 6-7 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you don't mind, let's hear something else. What would you like to play now, Art?
How about a really upbeat, fun song about parental abandonment?
Oh. By the way, real quick, you can stream this on YouTube. We are live in the studio right now with Everclear, so here we go.
Father mine, tell me where have you been? Just close my eyes, my whole world disappeared. Father mine, tell me back to the day. Yeah, when I was still your golden boy, back before you went away. Remember blue skies, walking the block. Loved it when you hit behind. Man, I love to hear you talk. Take me to the movies. Take me to the beach. Take me to a place inside. So hard to be. Father mine, tell me where did he go? Had the world inside of him, don't I seem to know? Father of mine, tell me where did you go? Had the world inside your hand, did not seem to know. Father of mine, tell me what do you see? When you look back at your wasted life and you don't see me, I'll never be safe. I will never be sane.
Song guts me every time.
Everclear on 93.3 WMMR. That, the most beautiful thing about that song, and I'm actually getting a little choked up
likewise
as I'm speaking here, is the final verse and the redemption. You know, it's your story. It's not my story. I don't know why I get so emotional.
Because you can connect.
But it's, I've learned from these things. I've learned what not to do in life. I've taken this negative experience, and I'm going to channel that into something positive. It's so beautiful. It's just amazing.
Man. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I never planned to write that song. I just remember. I mean, who's parents here? Who's got kids?
A bunch of us here.
So, you ever watch your kids sleep?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you're poor. I mean, there's nothing else to do. But it is just one of those redeeming things where you feel like, hey, I didn't screw this one up.
Right.
This is pretty cool.
Yeah.
This is what's going on here, you know, and you start thinking about what all these implications are. And I remember watching my daughter sleep. She must have been about 5 or 6. Yeah, no, younger. Yeah, 4 or 5. And I just remember just thinking, how does a man walk away from that? How
yeah
do you actually do that? I don't know how you do that. I wasn't raised like that. I was raised by my mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have any bad feelings about my dad. He died a few years ago. Didn't really know him. You know, I mean, had kind of a okay relationship. Tried to get closer to him, but he just wasn't able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised by my mom, single mom. And after that kind of epiphany, I went in my office and just stayed up all night and wrote that song.
What did your mom think about the songs like that when she heard them?
As long as it wasn't about her.
Okay.
I wrote some songs about my mom. She didn't like those too much.
Okay.
But they were really good. They were just hard. You know, it's funny. Someone asked one of my sisters, who I'm not really close to, but asked one of my sisters, you know, what's your brother like? Is that real? Did he like add a lot of stuff? And she goes, Arthur was being nice.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Being kind.
Wow. It's, you know, your ability as a songwriter to things that I may not have experienced in my life, but can tap through to. And that's why I'm not a dad, but I had a dad. And I know, you know, all of those things. And just to with the economy of your writing to get right to the point, there's a great song that I've always loved that you've done, Learning How to Smile.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
And it's, I think you've called that the best song you've ever written. Is that
one
correct?
One of them.
Yeah.
It's up there. That and I think a song called Summerland that was on Sparkling Fade.
When you're done with the song, when you have it the way you want it, do you walk away? And is it that moment you say, okay, this is in the pantheon, or does it become that over time?
I think I don't know about Pantheon because that's a fancy East Coast word. We don't have that on the West Coast. Do we?
There's no Pantheon.
No,
it's not a Pantheon.
On the West Coast, that would be a band name.
Pantheon. We have Pantry.
Yeah.
But somewhere in there, you threw Pantheon.
It's a hair metal band.
Yeah. It's
like, we're Pantheon.
Yeah. Pantheon. Hi, I'm in a band. Pantheon. Yes, Steve. I mean, it's like if when I've written songs like Father of Mine, I knew I had something.
Okay.
I thought I had something, and I played it for my A&R guy in L.A., and he's this, at the time, he was like this, you know, 45-year-old Brit, very stoic guy, and he got all kind of misty behind his glasses. But outside, we heard, like, this noise, and we walked out where the assistant secretaries were sitting, and they were all sitting on one desk, hugging each other, sobbing.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And my A&R guys, he's like, I don't know if it's a single, but it's definitely going on the record.
Well, when I was in, I won't say what year, but there were two albums, two soundtracks that were on rotation in my Discman. It was the Empire Records soundtrack and the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack over and over. And every time I heard Local God, I had to play it at least three or four times. How did that end up on, I mean, Baz Luhrmann, did they choose it? Was it already written? Did you write it for the movie?
Well, I did write it for the movie.
Oh.
I did, actually. I was in New York City. We were doing the MTV Music Awards that we were on, that Chris Rock was actually hosting back in, I think, 96.
No incidents there, right?
No, I didn't slap him right. Yeah, he probably would have slapped me back. But I... remember they asked me when we had just come back from Europe, my family had flown in, my daughter was there, my wife, and we're staying at this fancy hotel, and they had asked me to do the song for this, and they sent me like a little bit of the video of the scene they wanted us to be in. And I'm pretty well versed in Shakespeare. I studied Shakespeare back when I was in college. And you know, and I knew the scene that they were talking about from the original Shakespeare, even though it had guys with tattoos and lowriders and stuff.
John Leguizamo.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I was, I went shopping with my wife, and I heard, like, bass and drums, which in the mid-90s was kind of, like, the cool thing. And I kind of dug that loopy kind of feel to it. And I went back to the room. It was the day before the awards. I went back to the room and wrote that song. Yeah.
That's wild.
Was it difficult to write? I mean, is it difficult? It's almost like being given an assignment in school saying, you know, here's your theme.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes I'm like, I can't. I'm either interested or not.
Okay.
I can either do it or I can't. But I felt like I could on this. And incidentally, so it was on that soundtrack because we were on Capitol and it was a Capitol soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And we made more money off that one song on that soundtrack than we made on Sparkling Fairy.
No way.
That's
really
crazy.
Yeah, it's
because,
crazy.
Wow. Because we had that platinum record, we could go in and just, you know, kind of everything to the wall and just negotiate this great thing. We made a lot of money off that. But incidentally, we go to Australia later that year and we're getting ready to play, and the head of EMI Australia, the head of the record company, is like, why aren't you playing Local God? And I go, because it's the soundtrack. He goes, mate, it's a number one hit here on three different formats.
Oh, my God.
You got to play that song.
Yeah.
So we had to figure
it out. It's funny. We were talking earlier about Kate Bush has Run Up That Hill. It's become a massive hit.
From Stranger Things.
Stranger Things decades later.
I've got a 14-year-old. I know
what there you go. Nice. I wanted to ask you quickly about mentioning MTV and there was the documentary about the 99 Woodstock, and you were there.
Thank God they didn't mention us. Everybody they mentioned, they just tore apart.
But you had a different take on it slightly than, I mean, it sucked.
Oh, it sucked.
It was horrible.
You saw it. Like, I was there, and you could see as a fan on our end, it's just sort of descending into madness. You could see it, like, Saturday. You're like, dude, there's something wrong is happening here.
The different take you're talking about is
we were on stage. Yeah.
Yeah, no, we had 300,000 people singing the words to Santa Monica.
It's got to be one. It's a city.
That was just a city.
Yeah.
That's a good-sized city.
Yeah.
And that makes you think because there was no plumbing, there was no water. Water they were selling water for like $8 a bottle.
Yeah, it was crazy. Way too expensive, is what
eight
it was.
To $10 a bottle.
Yep.
And some people were buying a lot of it and then selling it for even more. And there was girls getting abused,
that.
Raped, and like doing sexual favors with the crew underneath the stage to get on stage. Oh. There was all sorts of just horrible things going on. But that hour that we were on stage was transcendent.
Well, I love how you observed that you said you guys beat a hasty retreat when you found out that the Chili Peppers were handing out candles.
Yeah, that was just that was gonna go south. We're like, oh, yeah, we're done.
That's the biggest audience you've ever played for, I would assume.
Probably.
Yeah. Wow. Well, the show is tonight at Keswick Theater. You can get tickets at keswicktheater.com. I got time for one more. If you guys would indulge, it'd be great.
You got it.
All right. This is Everclear on MMR.
Hey, thanks for having us here.
Anytime.
We love coming back. You know that. Let's call Santa Monica. I am still living with your ghost. Lonely and dreamy of the West Coast. I don't wanna be your downtown. I don't wanna be your stupid game. With my big black boots and an old suitcase. Do believe I find myself a new place. I don't wanna. I don't wanna do your sleepwalking. I just wanna see some trees. Go away, try to shake your disease. We could live beside the ocean, leave the fire behind, swim out past the breakers, watch the moon die. We could live.
Monica, MMR. I have to ask because that's the song that really launched the band. What was the kernel of inspiration to write that song?
I was living in Portland. We got we just got signed to Capitol. We were getting ready to go to Seattle to film a video for a song off World of Noise, a song called Fire Maple song, and then we were driving from there straight across to Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, at Smart Studios, where we recorded this. We recorded Sparkle and Fade. And I had been suffering from anxiety, depression for a while. I was clean, but, you know, when I got clean, I just started having panic attacks and stuff like that. And when I drove to the beach with my wife and my daughter for a few days, it just went away. All the anxiety went away. And then when I started heading back away from the ocean, it all came back. And when I got home, I wrote a song about comfort zones, because I grew up by the ocean. I grew up on the west side of LA, Santa Monica, Venice, Culver City. And I wrote the song and recorded it, and my A&R guy thought it was amazing, thought it was going to be a hit, which he was right. Forced us to make it a little bit longer. That's another story. But he was right.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I called it Santa Monica, because that's my comfort zone. That's right. Where I was from. That's where I grew up.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, you can't call it that. You don't say Santa Monica. You say that. You can watch me call it that. Yeah. But for radio, the one caveat I made was that for radio, you call it Santa Monica in parentheses, Watch the World Die.
Right.
Because they're like, no, you need to change that to Watch the World Die. And the president of Capitol was constantly calling me names and just like, no, you got to do this. I'm telling you, you got to do this. You're going to ruin your career. I go, well.
Why, you
still got to pay me, Ace.
Why did you feel so strongly about that title? I mean, it seems like a little thing. As an artist, it might not be.
I grew up with Led Zeppelin, and Led Zeppelin named a lot of songs that they didn't have.
That had no
correlation. I still like, oh, yeah, that's Black Dog, right? Yeah, right. That's, you know.
We play them all the time, and we can't name the title.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody does that. This meant something to me. This wasn't some ambiguous kind of trying to be cool thing.
Right.
Santa Monica was swim out past breakers, watch the world die. That was the imagery of what I grew up with.
You know, you got.
I used to do that. I used to go. You know, I was drunk or
high
with friends. We'd swim out and we'd be out there in the dark and just like, God, I hope a shark doesn't bite me.
You always have to remember that. And I always say, like, and there was a series that just wrapped up called The Offer about the making of the original Godfather, and they fought Francis Ford Coppola on Al Pacino at every turn. Mm-hmm. He was right. Yeah. So there you go. Sometimes what's in your gut is right.
Sometimes, especially when you're young and hungry like that, and the fire's in your belly for sure.
Right.
But,
Well, here we are 30 years later, and you guys are celebrating the anniversary tour of the anniversary of the album World of Noise. And there's a deluxe edition that's available if people would like to get that.
For the first time on digital platforms. It's never been on digital platforms.
Oh, that's wild.
Before, so it's remastered. It's got 6 bonus tracks. 2 of them have never been previously released. And it sounds great.
Excellent.
I mean, it's raw, you know?
Yeah. You sound great.
But you can tell, if you like the later stuff, you can tell where it came from when you hear this. This is the root of all of it, for sure.
Well, we have some tickets to give away to the show tonight. We'll take the 15th caller, 215-263-WMMR. Not only Everclear, but Fastball, and the Nixons are going to be playing.
That's a fun bill, man.
Absolutely.
It's going to be rock and roll.
Tickets, details, WMMR.com. So we'll take that caller now, and we will give you tickets. This has been such a blast. Thank you guys for being here this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you here. Everclear, guys, have a great show tonight. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us.
Get the whole Preston and Steve show or the Bizarre Files podcast at PrestonandSteve.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.